From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, and this morning we kick off, Jay Burke and I, with a conversation with local fitness trainer Dr. Alex Wetmore. He is a PhD in sports physiology and performance, and he's the director of coaching at Off the Mountain and a 100-year athlete here in Park City. And then we speak with New York Times best-selling author Eric Weiner, who follows in the footsteps of Benjamin Franklin, mining his life for inspiring and practical lessons in a book that's part biography, part travelogue, part personal prescription for a fuller, more meaningful life. The book is called Ben and Me. These guests, when we return, you're listening to The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City. Stay with us. This morning, we welcome to the show someone whose knowledge about training and fitness will rival anyone's. Dr. Alex Wetmore has a PhD in sports physiology and performance and is the director of coaching at Off the Mountain 100-year athlete here in Park City. Alex came to Park City from pro soccer club Real Salt Lake, where he was the academy head of performance. We're excited to talk to Alex today about training and fitness. We know this guy can answer all of our questions. Alex, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you are just a very accomplished person in your area of expertise. Why did you decide to go this route? And why have you become the expert that you are?
So I think similar to many young athletes and young coaches, mine really started out of a passion for my own sport and performance. So I grew up playing football and track and rugby and had the opportunity to play football in college. So when I was kind of choosing a career path and a major course of study, it naturally made sense for me to try to understand some of the things I was doing on a daily basis. So that grew into a true passion for performance as I kind of transitioned out of my own athletic days and into my coaching roles.
Can you comment on, you know, when you went to school, and you don't have to tell us when you graduated, but I would imagine that in this world, I mean, all fields evolve and change, but it seems like the world of sports, physiology and performance, fitness, training, all of that just changes immensely over the time. How do you keep up?
Yes. Our field specifically has changed a huge amount, even from when I began my undergraduate studies. And you know, similar to any field, new technology comes out. Everybody is publishing research, trying to improve what we do year on year on year. And it really does just take a lot of diligence in trying to stay well-read, stay up to date, make sure you're keeping up with other coaches in your area that might have been experiencing things that you haven't done yet. So for me, it's just been, number one, something I really enjoy doing. So it doesn't feel like a task to, you know, go in and spend a few hours keeping up with the newest research. And I can see the direct impact on the people that I work with.
All right, Alex, good morning. It's great to see you. I'm lucky enough to be able to see Alex usually a couple of days a week. So when I go into the gym personally, which is awesome, and we always end up chatting about this, that, and the other, which I really enjoy. But I want to ask you about kids and sport. And I think the one topic that always comes up in having kids who went through sports, you know, multi-sport, should they specialize? And I'm sure you get that lead all the time. Hey, my child is XYZ and doing this, and we want to go down that road. So can you talk to the listeners a little bit about that and what your philosophies are?
Yeah, I think this is one of the most common questions that we get when we talk to parents whose kids have, you know, high performance dreams, right? So there are several pros and cons. The pros to spending a lot of time in a specific sport track early on are that you develop the skills for that sport very quickly. So if you think of, you know, very technical sports, maybe something like golf or ski racing, something like that, then you will develop the feel and the coordination for that sport quickly. However, the downside is that if kids select their single track too soon. And oftentimes they miss a lot of that well-rounded fundamental development. And that can lead to complications further down. Things like overuse injuries come to mind. Kids are spending most of their year, especially with the rise of, you know, club sports and travel leagues and whatnot, doing very repetitive movement patterns. Their training loads are pretty constant all year, so they never really have a chance to recover and respond from that whole season. So the compromise is either to have a very steep rise in your performance early on, or to delay that and have a more gradual rise, but a higher ceiling longer down the road. So my personal opinion is that at the early stages, kids should be playing as many different sports as they can, trying to learn these fundamental movement patterns and how to coordinate themselves. And as they start to figure out what sports they really like, as they get into late middle school, high school, into college, then they can really start to narrow down their focus of what they're working on.
First of all, what do you define early as? Until when do you feel like?
So I, as a general rule of thumb for me, anything that is pre-adolescence would be considered early sport participation. So those younger ages where kids are getting into youth sport, maybe they're doing different sport camp programs, trying to figure out what they like. Mm-hmm. I think they should be trying as many sports as they can and find out, number one, what are their strengths and weaknesses? What kind of areas do they seem to excel in? And two, they just get an opportunity to learn a lot about themselves and how they move, how they feel, and how coordinated they are. As you get through adolescence and kids start to figure out, I'm generally good at these kind of activities. Maybe it's more on the strength and speed side of things. So something like, you know, a track runner and maybe a wide receiver come to mind, where kids are very good at, you know, similar sport qualities, then they can start to narrow those things down as they get into early high school age and start to look at what's down the road as far as possibly college and further on.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with Dr. Alex Wetmore. He is the director of coaching at Off the Mountain and 100-year athlete in Park City. It's funny that part of your title is a 100-year athlete. That's the aging athlete. And we will get to that in just a moment. But continuing in the thread of young people, at Off the Mountain, you know, how often are you getting kids in there to train and coach? Because it seems like the coaches within their specific sports are doing a lot of that, and kids might not have time for more than that. But talk about the structure of how you host kids there.
Yeah, we have a pretty large group of kids that come train with us every week. I've had kids as young as, you know, 8, 9 years old come in, and we're teaching them really fundamental things like, how do you run with a proper gait? You know, how do you control your posture as you go through a deep lunge or a squat? It can start off very simple. And we have a lot of groups of middle school and high school age kids. And, you know, oftentimes we're lucky enough to have kids that have graduated and gone on to play in college, come home and train with us over the summer. So we've got a full span of younger athletes that are coming into the gym each week. And I think what we really excel in is developing programs that complement what's happening out on the field or out on the court. So it's not a, you know, either train with your team or train with us, but rather can we develop an approach that works together and helps you guys to perform?
So my question, Alex, is around the fact that you've got all these kids coming into the gym for this sort of extracurricular training outside of their sport. It either speaks to maybe one of a couple of things. One is we just have a lot more people in town who can pay for that kind of coaching for their kids. Or I'm hoping this is what it is that people have gotten the message about overuse injuries and early specialization not being great for kids. And so they've decided to bring their kids in to make sure that doesn't happen. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, I definitely think the message is coming out about that. Park City being such an active outdoor town too, we've seen those injuries pop up, whether people are young or older, right? So parents just want the best for their kids. They want them to have a really good experience. And I think, you know, the biggest thing that we try to hamper in is that we are going to teach your kids when they come in the knowledge they need to be able to train for their lifelong, you know, outdoor activities, whether it's competitive or not. So our goal is to try to help people learn at a young age how they can take care of themselves for the long run. And you know, the research is pretty clear that youth strength training has a huge effect on not just overuse, but even, you know, bigger injuries that you might see from contact or pulled hamstrings or anything like that. So I think it's hopefully getting out there, and parents are really starting to believe in it.
Well, Alex, let's talk a little bit about something. I know you and I go down this road a lot, like, and not just necessarily pointed down at younger athletes, but as we age as well, and that's the simple art of running. You know, I know we spend a lot of time talking about this. I'm always like, I think running is the core of everything. And you know, I was lucky enough to learn how to run properly at an early age. I mean, I don't know how that happened growing up in the middle of nowhere, Idaho, but somehow it did, and had great coaches along the way. But it's benefited me, I feel like, greatly through the years, just with all athletics. And I still try to run fast on occasion at you know, being over 50. So how do you develop that with the kids these days, you know, when they come into the programs?
Well, the first thing we do with if any new client, whether they're young or older, is we take them through an assessment. And the goal here is to learn about their history, learn about injuries, and then really watch how they move. So that helps us to develop a directional plan for kids. And we kind of know that and what they need help with. As far as developing proper running technique, there are kind of two approaches. So the first is, if they're young, they need to just simply learn the skill. How do you move your body in the right planes? How do you feel what range of motion you should be following and where your foot should be striking the ground? So that is as simple as practice makes perfect, while getting proper coaching as you go. The second part of that is that in order to have the right running technique, you need to be strong enough to do it, just simply because body mass is constant. And if you can't put enough force into the ground, then you start changing things to help yourself out each step. And when those things come in, and say somebody takes up endurance running and they've got, you know, this or that wrong with their technique, that's thousands and thousands of reps every week where they're putting more stress on one area of their body than another. So that's where those kind of long-term overuse things pop up.
Well, let's circle back to the kids. I think we see more and more as kind of the mental side of training with these kids, or the kids specializing, and maybe the desires of the parent being placed on the kids. And I mean, as a trainer, someone with the amount of schooling that you have, what is being taught to you to pass on to these kids and the families? And I mean, how do you navigate that as a parent, you know, the mental health and well-being of the kids that are athletes?
Yeah, absolutely. And everybody knows it's ever been in a competitive environment that it can be stressful. And that stress can either help forge something really great, or it can be, you know, a big distraction for kids that are putting a lot of their heart and soul into, you know, these teams and these goals. So I think that the most important thing we can do as coaches and trainers is provide a really positive experience for these kids. So we strive every day to make sure we get to know every kid that's through the doors. We know, you know, what are the things they enjoy? What are the things maybe they don't? And a lot of times parents will give us some insight into that at home. And this is what, you know, my son or daughter is struggling with when they're at school or they're at practice. And we can use time in the gym to help reinforce some of those messages. And I think one of the most important things as far as strength training goes is it teaches kids at a young age the value of delayed gratification, because it takes time and it takes effort to really see improvement and to build up all of these qualities we're working on. So it can help really enforce that message that's going to serve them well for the rest of their lives.
Yeah. Alex, you are, again, the director of coaching at Off the Mountain and 100 Year Athlete. That is the former Minerstown CrossFit gym, and a lot of people know it as that. But I think that your philosophy of training is much different than CrossFit, but I'm not sure. It's still called Minerstown, correct?
Yeah, maybe so you can go through that whole philosophy and changeover.
Sure, yes. Miners Town Strength and Conditioning and Off the Mountain operate together in the same space. So 100 Year Athlete is kind of the umbrella organization, and Off the Mountain Strength is our in-town, in-person training center. So the Miners Town side and the Off the Mountain side share the same space, but publicly facing, most people just refer to us as Miners Town Strength. And all of the kind of youth training and personal training occurs under Off the Mountain.
Okay. And then there is that 100 Year Athlete. Now, Jay and I, along with probably a good percentage of our listeners, we want to be still doing what we do at 100 years, which is kind of a pipe dream, right? But so I'd like to talk a little bit about the aging athlete. You know, some of the things that pop out for me as I age are things I used to get away with, you know, in my 30s and 40s, I'm not getting away with anymore. And I've noticed things like if I'm at all dehydrated or if I've gotten a poor night's sleep, my performance is just, you know, it's down the tubes. And so talk to us about the things that we don't get away with as aging athletes.
Yeah, you know, it's no shocker that as we get older, things do change just from a physiological standpoint. And we have to spend a little bit more time thinking about our plan, what our times look like, how we're feeling, right? And I think the biggest change is that as we start to add all these outside stressors outside of, like, you know, when you're a kid, you know, you've got school and you've got practice and you can put all of your energy into those things. But when you're an adult, you've got to balance all these other things between your career and your families and, you know, making sure you have enough time in the day to spend time with your family. So focusing on the recovery and the nutrition and the sleep aspect of it plays a much, much larger role as we start to age. I think the other thing, in my opinion, that we spend a lot of time focusing on through the 100 Year Athlete program is making sure we continue to hit what we call the 9 pillars of fitness. And those encompass everything from strength, speed, power, lean body mass, endurance, agility, all of those things. Because oftentimes as we get out of kind of organized sport and into just doing our own thing, we tend to focus just on what we like, you know, and that might be going out for a jog on the rail trail, or it might be sending it down the hills on the ski slopes, right? So as we get older, it's really important to make sure we don't only focus on one area and neglect other areas of our training, because they all kind of support each other to make sure we can keep doing what we love until we're 100 years old, hopefully.
Well, those 9 pillars of fitness feature, you know, I chat with people just about being physically active out in the mountains, and other is the mobility side of it. And I know you guys focus a ton on that, but we always spend a lot of time working on specific joints and areas of the body. But there are some things you all are doing that I feel could benefit a lot of people simply if you just are doing one thing, and that's what you all call KinStretch. Explain a little bit to the listeners what KinStretch is and just, you know, the benefits as one of those 9 pillars. I mean, there are other things you need to be doing as well, but this seems to be a pretty important component.
Yeah, so KinStretch is a program we offer that is a very focused, detailed approach to joint health training. So it's not just mobility or flexibility in the sense of coming in and doing stretching and using foam rollers and whatnot, but rather we're trying to intensively train your joints. So teach you how to move them, how to control them, help you to increase your range of motion if it's lacking in certain areas. So I think sometimes it surprises people how much you can do just focused on joint health training. So those classes happen every Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 8 a.m. in the gym. And we also offer online memberships for KinStretch, and they typically are an hour of focused joint health training in one area or another. So you might come in and one day we're going to focus specifically on hip rotation and lumbar spine. And the next day you come in, we might be focusing on shoulder mobility and knee health and things like that, depending on the time of the season around kind of the Park City sports scene.
Well, I'm just picking on, again, there are nine pillars here, but like I'm just picking on the few in my observations, and I've been lucky enough to be working with Ben Van Treese and Alex for many years. I mean, since Ben first came in, and one of the things I seem to notice a lot, just the lack of, I think it's the agility, pillar probably, but the lack as we get older, the lack of ability to move from side to side quickly or even forward. If you're out on the trail running or even hiking, that ability to act quickly and catch yourself. And I mean, I say this, I'm kind of laughing because I actually fell trail running last week, but I mean, that is a big piece. People might be like, how do you train agility in the gym? And it is very possible, and the benefits are great.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think that's one area that we tend to neglect as we get older and kind of just start picking our own training programs. So speed, agility, and power, we kind of clump together as one of the pillars. They're very similar qualities and they all support each other. So basically the idea is that you have to be able to do a couple of things to really have well-rounded agility and power. And that is one, move something light really quickly. And number two, move something heavy as fast as you can. So the idea is that you can produce force you need in a wide range of scenarios. And that's what helps us when we, are out trail running, you take a step and a rock shifts a little bit and you have to catch yourself quickly, right? So in a gym setting, that happens from a few different types of training. That could be anything from just doing a typical movement, like call it a squat or a lunge, and trying to do it as quickly as possible with the right range of motion. And then we pair that up with things like jumps or plyometrics, or maybe we're taking a medicine ball and doing side tosses into a wall or something like that. And the whole idea is that if you want your tissues to be able to work quickly and under stress, then you also have to train them that way, or else it doesn't really translate to some of the things you're doing out and about.
That brings up the question, Alex, about, about movement and about, I have this thing, my mother is turning 85 today, and happy birthday, Mom.
Yeah, happy birthday.
And and when I watch her move, it's very slow. As we age, our movement just slows down. If you see someone from behind, a lot of times you can tell sort of what decade they're in by how quickly they move. And so I'm always trying to move really quickly, like that's not going to happen to me. Yeah, can we go through our day just in whatever we do, practicing good posture, moving quickly? And is that enough to just have that mindset all the time, or do we have to specifically train?
So I think you can get some benefit just from your daily habits, right? So things like there's something called CARS that stands for controlled articular rotations. Basically, that's just helping maintain as much joint health and workspace as possible. Those are things we advocate for people to do every day. If you get up in the morning and you start your pot of coffee, then you've got 5 minutes while it brews where you can go through a few of these little basic mobility things, starting as simple as, neck movement to make sure we don't get kind of hunched forward from sitting at a desk all day. Those are things that can be done anytime, anywhere, really. I like to tell people to kind of challenge how they move in their daily lives. So if you're picking something off the ground, maybe you practice both squatting all the way down with your torso upright and picking it up that way, or maybe you, take a lunge or a knee and you pick something up that way so that you don't just get stuck in these, really repetitive movements. But the honest truth is that if you really want to be as, optimized as possible long-term, then you have to have a really focused approach to it, because it needs to be progressive, needs to have a plan so that you can see progress from week to week and month to month. So in my opinion, you do have to put in the effort and go train too.
Great. Okay, Alex, final question. And what are the nine pillars of fitness to leave our listeners with?
Yeah, so the nine pillars of fitness is something that we've actually adapted and modified from a guy by the name of Dr. Andy Galpin. He's brilliant in our field and one of the kind of leading thought platforms. But the nine pillars of fitness are skill, technique, or kind of movement patterns. Two would be speed. Three is power. Fourth is force and or strength. 5 would be muscle hypertrophy or building lean mass. 6 is muscular endurance. 7 is anaerobic capacity. 8 is maximal aerobic capacity. And 9 is long duration training. So if you cover all of those things within your year, then you are pretty much hitting every area of performance. And we typically tell people, if you're listening just to these 9 things, you're like, holy cow, that's a lot. I've got to get into my training. So we kind of ebb and flow with the seasons and what you're doing. So around the Park City area, we kind of have 2 in seasons and 2 out or off seasons. So the in seasons would be like skiing season or anything kind of outdoors in the snow in the wintertime. And off season would be kind of that mud season transition. Now we're about to be back into in-season mode where people are trail running and mountain biking and climbing. And then we'll have a final off season as we're in the fall, kind of getting prepared to get back out in the snow. So you can kind of pick 2 or 3 qualities in each of those seasons.
Excellent. Dr. Alex Wetmore, he is a sports physiologist and trainer extraordinaire. He's the director of coaching at Off the Mountain and 100-Year Athlete. Alex, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on, guys.
Benjamin Franklin was a founder, statesman, a scientist, an inventor, a diplomat, and on and on. He was so many things. He conducted groundbreaking electrical experiments and believed deeply in the American experiment. But Ben Franklin's greatest experiment was Ben Franklin. In that spirit of betterment, our next guest, best-selling author Eric Weiner, embarked on an ambitious quest to live the way that Ben lived. And he's turned that endeavor into a book called Ben and Me, In Search of a Founder's Formula for a Long and Useful Life. Eric Weiner is the author of the New York Times bestsellers, The Geography of Bliss and The Geography of Genius, as well as Man Seeks God and The Socrates Express. He's a former international correspondent for NPR, and his work has appeared all over The Atlantic, National Geographic, Washington Post, and The Wall Street Journal. Eric Weiner, welcome back to The Mountain Life.
Great to be back with you guys again.
Well, let's start with this great story. You're such a good storyteller, and it starts in the opening lines of your book. But it's about when you were a correspondent for NPR and you were in Kabul and you were negotiating, or shall we call it haggling, over buying a rug. And tell us that story about what the shopkeeper says to you and then sort of how you get interested in Ben Franklin.
Right. So Ben Franklin snuck up on me when I wasn't looking. So this was a number of years ago. I'm in Afghanistan, as you said, and I'm taking a break from reporting for NPR, and I dip into a carpet shop to buy a carpet, see the one I like, and the shopkeeper wants U.S. dollars. No surprise there. That was the currency that people wanted. So I take out 10s and 20s, and he says, no, only Franklins, only Franklins. I thought, wow, all the way out here in Afghanistan, they know Benjamin Franklin because he is, of course, the face of the $100 bill. And I sort of thought, I really should know more about Benjamin Franklin. But I was busy, you know, reporting and covering a war and seeing the world and all that. So I sort of just forgot about him until a few years ago, mid-pandemic, and my editor and Simon and Schuster and I are kind of casting about for my next book. And my editor says, why don't you write a book on UFOs? I'm like, I really did not want to write a book on UFOs, but I did want to keep my editor happy. So I did look into it. And long story short, is I stumble across an article called Our Founding Fathers Alien Obsessed. And it turns out that many of the founders believed in intelligent life in the universe. And one of them was Benjamin Franklin. Started reading about him, about his quest for moral perfection, about his 13 virtues, and I was hooked. And then I knew that this was the book I had to write.
So among Ben Franklin's many virtues are, you know, some shortcomings or, you know, some lack of perfection, which makes him very human. And I think to a certain degree was maybe also what drew you to him, that here's this incredible person who was so useful in his life, and yet.
It turns out, this may come as a surprise, that I am not perfect either. So we have that in common, Ben and me. And I just, let me just say something about history, that I think we need to take a different approach to the founders and to historical figures, because we seem to be hooked on this one famous expression that those who forget the past are doomed to repeat it. And that's true for the bad things from the past. But what about learning the good things from the past? Those who forget those lessons are doomed not to benefit from them. So I do not attempt to conceal Franklin's imperfections and his missteps. It's all in the book. But I set out to appreciate him and to mine his ideas and his life for practical lessons that we can all apply to our lives.
Well, before we get too much further into the book, I want to know a little bit about your processes. I mean, someone like Benjamin Franklin, I mean, the depth and the width of what he did in so many different, you know, verticals, if you will. I mean, how do you...
I can see Franklin liking that term verticals, because I mean, that's the thing. I call him the least dead of the founders. I can see him totally latching onto the concept of verticals. I can see him in a coffee shop in Park City, you know, with his MacBook Air Pro and his noise canceling headphones. I mean, he totally fits in. Anyway, continue.
Well, I want to know the process as I was learning about the book and you, and how far do you go on one topic, and how deep, and where do you find that information?
There's no substitute for digging deep and for going down dead ends. And so Franklin wrote really only one book in his life, and he didn't even finish it, his autobiography. It just sort of peters off when he was age 57. But he left a huge paper trail of correspondence that are compiled at Yale University. They're up to 44 volumes now, each volume, like, you know, 800 pages. So it's huge. This was the email of the day. They called it the Republic of Letters. This is how people communicated. And newsflash, their letters are way more thoughtful and deeper than our emails, most of them. So I read a lot of what Franklin wrote in correspondence. And I also traveled. This is partly a travel log. It turns out that Franklin was the best traveled of the founders, best traveled American of his day. He logged 42,000 miles, crossed the Atlantic 8 times, you know, visited at least half a dozen countries. So I go in his footsteps to London and to France, and of course, Boston and Philadelphia. And so my process is a combination of in the library and on the road, basically. And this has been, and inside myself, and trying to, you know, bring out my own, make me a character in the book as well. And this is the approach I've taken for pretty much all of my books.
Wow. Well, thanks for sharing that. So as we get into the book, then can you kind of set the table with the 13 virtues? I mean, is that what it's written around to some degree?
That's what hooked me at first. And I'll just tell you about the 13 virtues. So Ben finds himself back in Philadelphia after an ill-fated journey to London as a young man, and as an 18-year-old. He's now 20, and he's trying to get his act together. Maybe you've gone through one of those got-to-get-my-act-together phases. And he comes up with this list of 13 virtues that he's going to attempt to follow. And just to give you an idea, the first one is temperance. And he put that one first because he figured if you were not sober, you couldn't do the other 12. Others include silence, order, resolution, sincerity or honesty, cleanness, tranquility, chastity, which is unusual given his reputation. And then he had 12 at first, and a Quaker friend said, Ben, you're not really a very humble person. Maybe you should add humility. So he's like, oh, yeah. So he added the 13th. Humility. And he was very big on method. So he thought that everyone basically knew the right thing to do. They just didn't know how to go about it. So he came up with this book, notebook, where he would write kind of a grid, and he'd have one virtue per week, and he would try to stick to it. And anytime he veered away from, say, silence and talked too much, he would put a little check mark. And he had so many marks that the book was just filled with marks. And he realized he was not as perfect as he thought he was. So the experiment was kind of a failure, but at the same time, he said by aiming high, he was like a calligrapher who modeled himself after the masters, and in doing so, bettered his hand. And I think that's the point. And I credit him for aiming for something as audacious as moral perfection, as he called it.
Yeah. So wondering how you, Eric, you know, after researching him so much, did you find yourself transitioning as you were researching him and you saw his quest for these virtues? Did you start to think about your own quest on a daily basis, or did you just evolve?
I'm not sure I'm evolving at all, but I do think that some of Ben's techniques have definitely stuck with me. One is this notion of errata, which is a printer's term. An errata is a mistake that ends up in, the say, a finished book. And nearly every book that's published, the first edition, has a typo or something in it. And what do publishers do? Well, they don't fret. They don't say, oh my God, I've sinned. You know, they don't beat themselves up. They issue a new and improved edition. And Franklin, as a printer by profession, that's how he made his name at first, he thought, That's what we should do with the mistakes we make in our lives. Just don't see them as sins. See them as errata that you can fix later on. And I think that approach takes the pressure off us to be perfect. And when we do miss the mark, to just issue a new edition of ourselves, better and improved. That's one example that I think I've applied to my everyday life. If I mess up, I'm like, okay, it's an errata. There'll be a new edition. Another is, I think, this the notion of usefulness, which is in the subtitle of my book, A Founder's Formula for a Long and Useful Life. And I didn't, you know, in theory, I wanted to be useful, but I didn't give it that much thought. But for Franklin, usefulness was his North Star, the guiding principle in his life. And I think we have very mixed feelings about this notion of usefulness. On the one hand, if I asked you guys, do you want to be useful? You would say, yes, probably, sure. But someone might, you know, come up to you, Lynn, and say, oh, your friend Chris, she's just using you, you know, and that would somehow be a character flaw on your part, that you're allowing yourself to be used. I think Ben Franklin would say, great, Chris is using me. You know, I want to be used. Please use me. You know, we only have so much time on this planet. Why not be like the candle that burns down to the base? That was Franklin's approach. So I find myself looking for more ways to be useful. I'm no Mother Teresa, nor was Benjamin Franklin, but it's finding the intersection between your abilities and people's needs. And that's what Franklin was a genius at.
Well, that's great. If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with bestselling author Eric Weiner. He has written a new book. It's about Ben Franklin, but it's also about all of us, and it's about him. It's about Eric. It's called Ben and Me. So, Eric, your new and very wonderful book, Ben and Me, is not a biography of Ben Franklin, and it's not a history, but it contains both of those things, biography, history. Can you better explain what exactly it is?
Yeah. So most biographies, first of all, are very long. I don't know. Someone decided they have to be at least 900 pages, you know, doorstops. Most tend to be strictly chronological, this year, this year, this year. And most tend to be a bit, I would say, dispassionate. And Franklin valued the personal. He valued brevity. And he valued humor. So I wanted to write the kind of book about Ben Franklin that Ben Franklin would want to read. So it is arranged by ideas as opposed to strict chronology. There are different Bens. There's Baby Ben, Mass Ben, Buddha Ben. Angry Ben, there's Naked Ben, which we can talk about if you want. And the idea is that there's a theme to each chapter in his life, and that I am wrestling with the same ideas that Ben was wrestling with in each chapter. So in short, I would say when I was going about this book, I didn't think of myself as writing a book about Benjamin Franklin. I thought of myself as encountering Benjamin Franklin, in a way having a relationship with him. And like all relationships, it's got its ups, it's got its downs.
Well, that really jumped out to me quickly was the way the book is arranged. It's very unique. And I think, you know, in those stories, and I'm going to bounce back a little bit. I mean, you know, you're talking about Benjamin Franklin and all these wonderful things he did. And he did have a kind of these darker corners. Where did you find those? I mean, did he embrace those openly and write about them, or did those come from other people in other sources?
Well, that's a good question. So in his autobiography, which is incomplete, yet one of the most, it's been called the most famous incomplete book in the world, Franklin presents the American dream, essentially. You know, he was born poor in Boston, had only 2 years of education. It became a classic, pull yourself up by your own bootstrap story, the American dream. And he's honest up to a point in the autobiography. I mean, he writes about his hijinks and some of these errata that we mentioned, and usually they're interpersonal. He, you know, didn't pay someone back for a loan or was youthful indiscretion, that sort of thing. But like many of us, the really serious flaws he's a bit blind to, and he hides from those, I think. I think one errata that he does not include in his book was the biggest in his life, probably, which is he never reconciled with his son, William, because William grew up under much more posh circumstances than Ben did, studied law in London, was a British loyalist to the end, did never switch sides to the American cause, and basically fought in the war quite actively as an intelligence agent for the British, fought against his father. And Ben could never forgive William for that. They were estranged. Ben Franklin wrote William Franklin out of his will. And I don't know, that bothered me, because Franklin was able to forgive almost everyone, including the British, for fighting a war, but he could not forgive his own son. I think that was one flaw in his life. You know, that one of the hardest subjects I had to wrestle with here was his relationship with slavery. So he had enslaved 7 Africans over the course of his life, mostly when he was younger, in his 40s and 50s. Then the more he learned about slavery and about Blacks, he had a change of heart. And fairly late in life, in his 70s and 80s, he freed his slaves and became a quite vocal abolitionist. The last thing he ever wrote, public piece of writing, was a satire mocking the institution of slavery. So I take heart in that. And one lesson there is always doubt your convictions. You know, even no matter how old you are, don't become more set in your ways, become more flexible in your thinking. And Franklin possessed that rare trait.
Well, that's a great segue and great stories there. Thanks for sharing those. But like the Benjamin Franklin effect.
Yes.
I think, you know, to those points you were just giving, I mean, tell us a little bit about the strategy he used for building relationships.
So here's the story. Franklin is a lowly clerk at the Pennsylvania Assembly in the 1730s. And there's a sort of aristocratic gentleman, very successful and wealthy, who doesn't care much for Ben, is about to make life miserable for him. And what could Ben do? He could kowtow, you know, offer to do favors for the man. Instead, he asked the man to do a favor for him. Franklin asked to borrow this rare and precious book he knew the man had. The man says, sure. Ben reads it, returns it a few days later with a nice note, and afterwards they get along swimmingly. Franklin's conclusion is that we don't like people who do favors for us. We like people who ask us to do favors for them. And it sounds counterintuitive, but several studies and academic journals in recent years have confirmed the Benjamin Franklin effect. I mean, it sounds a little nuts, right? Like, you think we would like people who do stuff for us. So why would we like people who ask us to do things for them? Well, one theory is cognitive dissonance. You know, we can't hold two competing ideas in our head at the same time. So let's say Jay doesn't like me, but I ask Jay to do a favor for me. And so Jay's like, well, I don't like Eric, but I'm doing a favor for him. So maybe I do like him. You resolve the dissonance that way. Or maybe we just like being useful. And if I give Jay or Lynn an opportunity to be useful, you're going to like me. So it's this quirk of human nature that he stumbled upon that is, I think, absolutely relevant today.
So, Eric, I'm wondering if during all of your research and all the people that you talked to, did you find that there are many people out there that think that Ben Franklin was actually a president when he wasn't? He was sort of before that time, although he was very significant as one of our founding fathers. And after all, his mugshot is on the $100 bill.
I call him the most famous president who was never president. A lot of people do overseas and even in the U.S. And the fact is he was too old to become president. He lived a long life until 84 years old, but he died in 1790. And George Washington wasn't inaugurated, I believe, until 1791. So he was a generation or two older than the other founders. And so at the Constitutional Convention 1787, he's old enough to be the grandfather of most of the other delegates and easily the father of all of them. And he was 81 years old at the convention, the exact age that Joe Biden is now as he seeks a second term. And I think Franklin shows us that you can be an effective and successful older leader. He had physical problems, suffering from gout and kidney stones, but his mind was sharp and he contributed mightily to the convention. So in a way, this debate about how old is too old to be president is not exactly anything new. There was ageism back in Franklin's time, but he powered through that and made a great contribution.
I mean, this book sounds so fascinating to me. And let's just talk a little bit. You know, we're all trying to find that way. And you just kind of touched on, you know, he was 81 years old, I think, when the founding fathers were getting together and pulling the Constitution together. And what were some of the lessons we could learn from him just in aging? I mean, what were some of the things he did? Or was he just one of those genetically gifted and he lived a long
time? No, I don't. I think he had good genes. I mean, his parents lived into their 80s as well, which back then was not unheard of, but it was unusual, less usual than it is today. What we don't realize about Ben Franklin is as a young man, he was buff. I could have had a chapter called Buff Ben in the book. He was, he lifted weights, he boxed, and he swam. He was an excellent swimmer at a time when very few people, not even sailors, knew how to swim. He never smoked and believed tobacco was going to go out of fashion at some point. He was right about that. And he did like wine. He did like his food. But he always exercised even later into life. So he had, you know, this, and he never really complained about his ailments. You know, reading his letters, he always was very sanguine about it. He's like, yes, I've got the gout and I've got kidney stones and I've got old age and only one of them is incurable, you know, and all in all, I can't complain, you know. He thought of all the ailments he did not have. It was an incredibly optimistic outlook on life, and I think that attitude helped him. He also never stopped learning and doing. The one thing that Franklin was a complete failure at was retiring. He attempted several times in his life to retire, and he was unable to because he was needed. And I think that sense of being needed, of being useful, having meaning in our lives, you know, more than, you know, cardio workouts and important as they are, I think that's what keeps people going well into their 70s, 80s, and 90s. And the other thing, as I mentioned earlier, that Franklin excelled at was this intellectual flexibility. You know, most of us, as we grow older, we become more set in our ways. You know, we've seen this. This is the way it is. It's the way I've always known it's this way. Franklin was always willing to doubt his convictions, and he gives this remarkable speech at the Constitutional Convention's closing. It's unclear whether it's going to pass, if people are going to, you know, vote for it. And he says, gentlemen, the older I've grown, the more I've grown to doubt my own convictions because I've been proven wrong in the past. And I'm paraphrasing here. If you have doubts about this document, so do I, but embrace those doubts and please sign it anyway. And it's one of the most remarkable speeches ever, I think.
Well, great points. And I mean, it just is amazing to me that in 1790, in the late 1700s, I mean, now we're revisiting some of these ideas on longevity and you know, exercise in the 1790s. Who knew?
Right. I mean, well, they never, I mean, the ideas we wrestle with now, they were wrestling with then. We just sure. have more modern technology. We have, you know, Wi-Fi, which works sometimes, doesn't always work. And sure. and Franklin had, you know, they had their technology, you know, the lightning rod, which he invented, bifocals, which he also invented. But the issues of, you know, democracy, fairness, openness, honesty. I mean, if you look at his list of 13 virtues, they're just as relevant, if not more relevant today than they were in his time. I think the problem is today the word virtue has a kind of a negative tinge to it. I think it's virtue signaling, or it implies a kind of holier than thou-ness. In Franklin's time, the word did not have that negative connotation. It was synonymous with character. Being a virtuous person was being a person of character, and everyone strived toward that.
Well, what a great book, and so fun to talk to you this morning, Eric. The book is Ben and Me in Search of a Founder's Formula for a Long and Useful Life. Eric Weiner, I'm going to just say here, you've had a useful life, and okay, a pretty long one too. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, guys. Have a happy and useful day.
Thank you, Eric.
Thanks for listening to The Mountain Life here on KPCW. You can hear this full episode wherever you get your podcasts, on the KPCW app, or by visiting the Shows tab at kpcw.org. If you like what you hear, leave us a comment, rate us, and be sure to subscribe to stay on top of all of our show episodes. And if you have an idea for a future episode of The Mountain Life, email us at themountainlife@kpcw.org.